Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. What does a man gain for all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets, panting, it returns to its place where it rises. Gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning, turning goes the wind, and the wind returns in its cycles. All the streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full. The streams are flowing to the place, and they flow there again. All things are wearisome. Man is unable to speak. The eye is not satisfied by seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Can one say about anything, "Look, this is new"? It has already existed in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of those who come before, and of those who will come after there will also be no remembrance by those who follow them. I, the teacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to seek and explore through wisdom all that is done under heaven. God has given people this miserable task to keep them occupied. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun, and have found everything to be futile, a pursuit of the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, "Look, I have amassed wisdom far beyond all those who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has thoroughly grasped wisdom and knowledge. I applied my mind to know wisdom and knowledge, madness and folly. I learned that this too is a pursuit of the wind. For with much wisdom is much sorrow. As knowledge increases, grief increases." Ecclesiastes is one of the weirdest, strangest, most confusing books in the Bible. In many ways, it almost feels like it shouldn't be in the Bible. It's bleak, it's dark, at times it feels very hopeless. It's just a strange book to find in the middle of the Bible. The Bible is a book that is full of beauty and full of redemption and healing and hope, and Ecclesiastes doesn't really read like that, at least not in parts. Ecclesiastes was written by, or it is at least the compilation, of the sayings of someone simply identified as the teacher. Now, he's a wise man in Israel, and he starts his book by declaring that everything is meaningless, that everything is absolutely futile, everything is vanity. Trying to find joy, meaning, identity, satisfaction, lasting satisfaction under the sun in this life is like chasing after the wind. You can't actually catch the wind, you can't find its beginning or its ending, you can't hold it in your hands, you can't corner it, so chasing the wind is a vain exercise. He says trying to find lasting satisfaction in this life is a vain exercise, it's purposeless. And he says everything is this way because life is a vapor. It's short, it's brutish, it's cruel, it's here today, it's gone tomorrow. Nothing we do ultimately matters if death is the end. Nothing outlasts us. Death renders everything absurd. And yet, strangely enough, the teacher gives advice throughout the book on how to live well, which seems like a really odd thing for a nihilist to do. Nihilism is a rejection of all religious and moral principles and the belief that life is meaningless. Nothing in the world has any real existence. And the teacher sounds, at least at the very beginning, like a nihilist. The teacher's position seems to be that everything is meaningless, and yet he goes on to say, "Guard your steps when you go to the house of God." What? I mean, if everything is meaningless, number one, is there a God? Can there be a God and be no meaning in the universe? And number two, if everything is meaningless, does it matter how I approach God? Why does it matter how I approach him? And yet, the teacher seems to think it matters quite a bit how you approach God. He goes on to say, don't be excessively righteous and don't be excessively wicked. It's like, okay, be good, but not too good. And don't be wicked, but you can be a little wicked.
Chapter 7 is all about living wisely, and my question is, what is wisdom if the universe is purposeless? What's right and wrong? How do we know how to live a moral life? Is there such thing as a moral life if everything is meaningless? And the teacher seems to think that there is such a thing as morality, and there is a way to live. So the teacher seems conflicted, and especially when he gets to the end, and he says this, "When all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is, fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil." So he starts the book, everything's meaningless and futile, and then he ends the book with, the conclusion of the matter is, fear God, and that's not a crippling fear of God, that's not a terror. By fear God, he means recognize God as God. You are not God. You are not on the throne. You are not the king of your own life. There's someone who created you that you are accountable to. Keep God as God. Don't try to be God. Keep God as God, right? Revere him. Fear God and keep his commands. Obey him. Live the way that he wants you, created you, designed you to live. And he says, this is for every human being, and there's going to come a judgment someday where God is going to hold everybody accountable to his standard, and everything's going to be revealed. All the good that we've done, and all the evil that we've done. And not just the evil acts that we've done, but the evil things that we've thought, and said, and felt. That's how he ends the book, which seems very strange. Everything's meaningless, so fear God, and obey him in all things. Those things don't really go together. And so a lot of commentators, they don't really know what to do with Ecclesiastes. One commentator says, "An overview of standard commentaries and introductions will quickly demonstrate that Ecclesiastes is amenable to conflicting interpretations. Is the author incoherent, insightful, or confused? Is he a stark realist or merely faithless? Is he orthodox or heterodox? Is he an optimist or a pessimist? Is the final message of the book, be like the teacher, the wise man, or the teacher is wrong, so do not fall into his trap? What is going on?" To help us answer the question, what is going on in the book of Ecclesiastes, I think we need to ask ourselves who the author of Ecclesiastes is. Who wrote it? The traditional view is that King Solomon is the author of Ecclesiastes. So the teacher, who speaks in the book, he claims to have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. He claims to be a son of David. He was obviously very wealthy and very wise and had a large harem. He had a lot of wives and a lot of women who were not his wives, but the women that he kept around for sexual purposes. And Solomon fits this description. Solomon was a son of David. He was a king. He was wealthy. He was wise. And he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. So Solomon seems to fit this description. And so for the traditional interpreter, they see Ecclesiastes as being written by King Solomon, and the unorthodox and skeptical teachings in the book are from the rebellious period of Solomon's life, and therefore they're not normative theology. He isn't commending these things. So Solomon starts out his reign really, really well. He's pursuing God. He gets wisdom from God. He's a godly king, and he's ruling in a godly way, but over time, his heart drifts from God. And we read in the account of King Solomon's reign that he gave himself over to an awful lot of ungodly things, and God became displeased with him and upset with him. He gave himself over to lots of women, and God was upset with him. He gave himself over to his wealth, and God was upset with him. So a lot of people, they read Ecclesiastes as kind of this book written at the end of Solomon's life, where Solomon is coming back to God, and he looks over his years of rebelling against God, and he looks over them with regret. And Ecclesiastes is almost like an act of repentance, an act of penance. He's looking over his wasted years, his godless years, and he's declaring meaningless. And he's warning the young, don't waste your life. Don't end up like me. Remember God. Fear God. Obey God. Now, that's a very enticing way of looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. But one of the challenges with that is that it doesn't actually entirely work with how the book reads. The book reads in many places not like a king looking back on his wasted years, but Ecclesiastes reads in many places like these are the present teachings, the present thoughts and beliefs of the teacher. Not the past beliefs, but the present beliefs. There are also some other problems with Solomic authorship. For instance, why would Solomon choose to use a pseudonym? Why call himself the teacher and not come right out and say that he's Solomon? He does that in many other places where he writes. While chapters 1 and 2 especially sound like they could have been written by Solomon, the book eventually shifts. So the first two chapters, especially chapter 2, sound like they are written by a wealthy king, someone like Solomon. But as you read on in the book, the teacher eventually starts to sound like an outsider to the royal office. He's not a king anymore. And he's looking at government from outside government. And he's skeptical of government and skeptical of authority. There was never a time in Solomon's life where he wasn't king. Once he became king, he died as the king. There wasn't a time where he was outside the royal office. Also, the Hebrew used in Ecclesiastes suggests that it was written quite late in Israel's history, and so not around the time of Solomon. And so, for these reasons, a lot of people have challenged, recently especially, this idea that Solomon is actually the author of Ecclesiastes, that Solomon is the teacher. Many have suggested that the teacher is not Solomon, and that the pseudonym is better explained as a literary device. So the teacher pretends he is Solomon, as he considers wealth and pleasure and philanthropy as sources of meaning, and what that means we'll get to next week when we look at chapter 2. So some people have suggested that Solomon is not the author of the book, but that the teacher at times pretends to be Solomon but isn't Solomon. Some people have also suggested that the teacher is actually not the author of the book. They would say that there are two voices in Ecclesiastes. There's the teacher, whose teachings make up the body of the book, and then there is the frame narrator, the actual author of the book, who has collected the teacher's sayings and is relaying them to his son. This author speaks of the teacher in the third person at the beginning and end of the book, and also in chapter 7 very briefly. So hence he sets the frame of the book, and is the in-the-background narrator guiding us through the sayings of the teacher, who speaks in the first person throughout the book. For those that read it this way, the teacher is the one who is unorthodox, but the frame narrator, the author, isn't. And the author ultimately redeems the book. So in this view, the author agrees with some of what the teacher says, but concludes the book by critically evaluating the teacher's sayings, offering a much-needed corrective and more positive outlook to everything is meaningless. The author relays the teacher's ideas and agrees with some of them and not with others. And at the end of the book, the author brings everything back to orthodoxy. He brings everything back in line with the ancient prophetic teachings of Israel. He brings everything back in line with the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. He ends the book with, when all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is, fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. So in this view, the teacher was a wise man who worked hard at his task, but he ultimately got it wrong. His speech serves as a cautionary tale of the dangers of speculative, doubting wisdom in Israel. So the teacher is right about some things, wrong about some things. The author brings it back to traditional, orthodox, ancient teachings of Israel. He brings it back in line with the Hebrew scriptures. The author is orthodox, the teacher is not. So that's a second view of Ecclesiastes. So the first view is Solomon's the author, And at the end of his life, he's looking back and he's lamenting and he's warning the young people not to be like him. Another view is the teacher is not Solomon, but is this unorthodox, skeptical philosopher, cultural commentator, wise man in Israel. And there's an author, a frame narrator, who's brought all of his teachings together, commends some, doesn't commend others, and concludes the book with an orthodox statement, fear God and obey him. Now, I lean towards the teacher and the author being two separate people. That's certainly how it reads. And I even lean towards the teacher not actually being Solomon himself. Now, I say lean towards because this isn't a hill I'm going to die on. This isn't a close-handed issue for me. This isn't like the full deity and full humanity of Jesus. This isn't a gospel issue. So I lean towards this, but I'm totally open to being absolutely wrong on this. At the end of the day, I don't think it really impacts the overall message of Ecclesiastes, whether it was written by Solomon or not. Solomon certainly doesn't come right out and claim to be the author. So if we don't think he is, I don't think that that matters much to him either if he actually was the author. So I lean towards the teacher not actually being Solomon himself. But here's where I disagree with the two views that I just expressed. I disagree that the frame narrator or the author offers a corrective to the teacher at the end. I don't actually think that the teacher and the author disagree with each other. I don't think the teacher is unorthodox and the author is orthodox. Listen to everything that the author has to say at the end of the book. He says this in chapter 12. In addition to the teacher being a wise man, he constantly taught the people knowledge. He weighed, explored, and arranged many proverbs. The teacher sought to find delightful sayings and write words of truth accurately. The sayings of the wise are like goads, and those from masters of collections are like firmly embedded nails. They hurt, but they're for our good. The sayings are given by one shepherd. But beyond these, my son, be warned. There is no end to the making of many books, and much study wearies the body. When all has been heard, the conclusion of the matter is, fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. If you read that end, the author is very, very complimentary of the teacher. It doesn't read like the author is merely obligatorily paying his respects. He gives the teacher high, high praise. Not only that, after he summarizes what the teacher has said, or the value of the teacher's sayings, in verse 12 he says, beyond these, my son, be warned. Beyond what? Beyond the teachings of the teacher. The author seems to be warning his son not to go beyond the words of the teacher. He says there's a lot of teachers and there's a lot of books. And it was true then and it's true now. There's a lot of books written on every subject. Pretty much every subject has been written on to death. You can't possibly read every book, listen to every podcast, listen to every interview, watch every documentary. You cannot exhaustively know the teachings, sayings, thoughts, philosophies, beliefs of every person who's ever expressed an opinion audibly or in written form, right? You just can't do it. You can't do it. He says there's lots of teachers and there's lots of books. And he seems to be saying, don't exhaust yourself with all of that learning. What I've given you in the teacher's sayings is enough. Don't go beyond them. But then he seems to add at the end, but if you do, remember this. The end, the conclusion of the whole matter is fear God and keep his commands, because this is for all humanity. The author wants to center his son, right? The author is relaying the teacher's teachings to his son. The author wants to center his son, no matter what, at the end of the day, on God. The conclusion of it all, of everything, no matter where you go, no matter what you hear, no matter what you learn, the conclusion of it all, what matters at the end of the day is fear God. recognize God as God, revere him and obey him, and know that there is going to be a judgment at the end of history where God will judge the world according to his standards. Honor him, respect him, live for him. Whatever else you learn, my son, be centered in this. So the author seems to think that this is what the teacher's saying, and that the conclusion, the grand summary of everything the teacher has to say is, fear God and keep his commands. Just be centered on that, my son. As you go out and read and learn, be centered on that. That's the conclusion of the matter. If I have to reduce everything, bring everything that the teacher has said down to one statement, this is it. So when I read the end, and again, I might be wrong on this, but when I read the end, it reads as if the author is not in conflict with the teacher. It seems like the author respects the teacher, wants his son to take the teacher's sayings seriously, and summarizes the teacher's sayings as fear God and obey him. For the author, the teacher is wise, and what he has to say is good. It's life-giving, it's hopeful, it's joyful, it's orthodox. The teacher isn't the cynical, nihilistic pessimist he has often been portrayed as. Yeah, he starts by uttering some very bleak statements, but as we'll see, he brings it around. He goes from darkness to light at several points in the book. For instance, when we get to chapter 3, he introduces the sovereignty of God, that there's a God who's the creator of everything, who is Lord over history, who is moving everything toward a particular goal or end, that there's a God that's on his throne, that's sovereign, that's ruling, and he can be trusted with our lives. So he starts bleak, but then he brings it around to this sovereign God in chapter 3, and there's a distinct shift in tone. And we need to remember that this wise man, this teacher, is a teacher in Israel. So when he's talking about God, he's not just talking about any God, he's talking about the God of Israel. He's talking about a God who he knows redeemed his people from slavery in Egypt. A God who rescued the nation of Israel from oppression and from slavery and from suffering and from tyranny and brought them into a promised land and made them into a great empire and gave them good laws and gave them the priesthood to help them approach him. He's talking about a God who makes promises, who's personal, who intervenes in human history and in individual human lives, a God who forgives, a God who saves, right? So when he's talking about a God who's in control of everything, that's the God that he's talking about. So what am I saying in all of this? For the teacher, I think he's holding up two different worldviews throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. And he's saying, if this life is all there is, if life under the sun, this life, is all that there is, if there is no God, if the world is indeed, to borrow Charles Taylor's language, disenchanted, there's no deities, there's no angels, there's no heaven, no hell, no demons, no devil, that there's nothing beyond what we can see, nothing beyond what we can taste and touch, right? If the world is indeed disenchanted and we live in an imminent frame, this life is all that we've got, then the teacher says, then everything is meaningless. Everything is futile. Everything is chasing after the wind. Everything is breath and vapor, here today and gone tomorrow. We're born, we eat, we sleep, we work, we marry, we procreate, we die. The cycle of our life is the cycle of everyone's life. We just keep doing the same thing over and over, and the earth just keeps doing the same thing over and over. Right? The sun keeps rising and the sun keeps setting. The seasons keep coming, fall and winter and spring and summer. The rivers empty into the lakes and the oceans. The cycle of life just keeps happening over and over and over again. Nothing is new. We can't actually change anything because we can't overcome what ultimately comes to us all which is death. And all of this makes life absurd. Everything we do is absurd. All of our efforts to make a difference are absurd, because at the end of the day, death comes to us all, and it ends everything and destroys everything, and everything's meaningless. So all of our attempts to live well and to make a difference are absurd if this life is all that there is. That's what he's saying about this one particular worldview. And in case you think he's being particularly bleak, a lot of materialists and atheists would agree with what he has to say. Bertrand Russell, who's a very famous atheist philosopher, he says this, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. He says, all the noonday brightness of human genius, it's destined for extinction in the vast death of the solar system. All of our achievements will be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. And he says, we've got to build our life on this firm foundation, unyielding despair. Nothing we do ultimately matters or makes a difference. Thomas Nagel, who's a contemporary American philosopher and also an atheist, he says this, if you produce a great work of literature which continues to be read thousands of years from now, eventually the solar system will cool, or the universe will wind down and collapse, and all trace of your effort will vanish. The problem is that although there are justifications for most things big and small that we do within life, none of these explanations explain the point of your life as a whole. It wouldn't matter if you had never existed, and after you have gone out of existence, it won't matter that you did exist. So Bertrand Russell, Thomas Nagel, other atheists and materialists, maybe some of you in the room, would agree with what the teacher says. If this life is all that there is, if it is disenchanted and it's an imminent frame, then yes, everything ultimately is meaningless. So the teacher holds up that view of the world, but then he says, but if this life is not all that there is, if there is a God, and not just any God, but the God of Israel, a God of redemption, a sovereign God, who's personal, if this life is not all that there is, then there is hope, and there is potential for joy, even in the midst of tragedy, suffering, death, and injustice, which the teacher is very clear throughout the book, makes up a lot of life. There's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of tragedy. And there's a lot of injustice. Ecclesiastes is not a book that you want to necessarily read before bed. It's very honest and clear. Life is hard. And it's sometimes brutish, cruel, and short. And if there is no God, then it's all meaningless. But if there is a God, then there's hope. And there's even the potential for joy in the face of that. And I think that this is the teacher's thesis. He's holding up two worldviews and ultimately commends the one that sees God as active in human history. He concludes his book, Fear God and Keep His Commands. This is for all humanity. I think in one sense he's saying, for life to be livable, we've got to believe in this God. If we don't believe in this God, then life is not livable. And that's really the question. That's the title of our series. Is life livable without God? And of course, technically, yes, life is livable without God. But the question is it truly living? Is it consistent living? Is it honest living? Is it joyful living? Is it abundant living? The thing is that even though maybe some of you and a lot of materialists and atheists believe that life is meaningless, even though a lot of people believe life is meaningless, we can't actually really live that way. The great Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., he once wrote to a friend, and he says, "If one thinks coldly, a modern person has to admit that there is no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon or a grain of sand." Right, as human beings, right, if you're a materialist, if this life is all that there is, if everything is the result of blind forces, physical forces, then human beings, at the end of the day, we are no more significant than a baboon, and we might be able to live with that, but he goes on to say, or even a grain of sand. But then he says this, then he added that when he begins thinking like this, it is time to go downstairs and play solitaire. It's like, when I stop to think about the implications of my view of the world, when I start to think coldly about it all, I have to immediately distract myself. He can't really live dwelling on the idea that everything is meaningless. To get on with his day, to have joy and hope and all of that, he's got to suppress his view of the world. He's got to set it aside. He's got to live in spite of it. He's got to distract himself with games and with fun. And in the West, we've got so many distractions, and I think that's part of the reason why we have so many distractions. Because we have come to believe that everything is meaningless, and we can't actually live with that idea. We can't actually live out the implications of that idea, so we distract ourselves. With Netflix and Amazon Prime and social media, we binge shows and we look at other people's lives for hours in pictures, and we spend hours, you know, following Reddit and just going from one article to the next, one conversation to the next, one meme to the next. We get drunk, we get high, we sleep around, we play video games, we do as much as we can to distract ourselves, because there's an emptiness that comes when we actually stop and think about the implications of this idea that everything's meaningless and there is no God. In the increasingly secularized West, that's what more and more people are believing, that everything is ultimately meaningless. And we can't really live with that. And so we distract ourselves like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. did. This is Tolstoy's journey in some ways. He abandoned God, abandoned the religion of his youth, and he decided he was going to live for the here and now. He was going to live to maximize pleasure, and he was going to become the most famous author in all the world and make a lot of money and live however he wanted. And he did that for many, many, many years. And then he started to sit back and look at, examine his life, and he started to think about the implications of a meaningless universe, and he became haunted by it. He says this in his Confessions, "My question, that which at the age of 50 brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions. Lying in the soul of every man, from the foolish child to the wisest elder, what will come of what I am doing today or shall do tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? Is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy?" The meaninglessness of it all started to overwhelm him, and he developed suicidal thoughts. Now, he didn't end up killing himself. He ended up returning to the religion of his youth in some ways, returned to God. But when he stopped and really thought about it, he went to places of despair. And he asks, Why do anything? Why live? Why wish for anything? Why do anything if death just destroys everything? Is there any meaning? Will my life come to anything? Will my doing today or tomorrow accomplish anything? And here's the thing, the teacher, I believe, the teacher wants to give a very hopeful answer to that question. Yes. Yes, your life matters. Your doing today and your doing tomorrow matters. Wishing for things matters. Doing things matters. Living matters. Your life matters. There's a God who created everything, who's personal, who intervenes in human history, who's on a throne, who's guiding everything. Live for him. Your life matters. Now, here's the beauty, is that we know even more than the teacher did. The teacher knew a God who rescued his people out of slavery in Egypt. But thousands of years later, we know that God even more profoundly. We know him as the God who became a slave to rescue us from ourselves. Paul, an early follower of Jesus, in one of his letters to the church in Philippi, says this, Philippians 2:5-8, make your own attitude that of Christ Jesus, who existing in the form of God did not consider equality with God as something to be used for his own advantage. Instead, he emptied himself by assuming the form of a slave, taking on the likeness of men. And when he had come as a man in his external form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even to death on a cross. I believe that Jesus is God in the flesh, that Jesus is God come to us. And what we see in Jesus is a God who serves. We see a God who took the judgment that we deserve unto himself so that we could be restored to him. Jesus died to bring us back to God. He served us all the way to the cross and died for us to bring us back to God. What do I mean by all of this? So the reason the world isn't the way it should be, the reason we're not thriving and flourishing and living as we ought, is because we haven't. We've done the opposite of what the teacher commends at the end of Ecclesiastes. We haven't feared God and we haven't obeyed God. The reason the world is the mess that it is, the reason that we are not living our very best lives, the reason that we are not flourishing and thriving and being all that we were created to be, is because we haven't treated God as God. We've tried to be our own gods. We've tried to de-God God, dethrone God, and put ourselves on his throne. We said we don't want to live the way that you want us to live. We want to live how we want to live. We want to determine right and wrong for ourselves. We want autonomy, and we separated ourselves from God. We distanced ourselves, severed our relationship with him, uncentered ourselves from him, and we've neglected him, ignored him, denied him, rebelled against him. Not only that, we haven't been living the way that God wants us to, but rather we have lived the way that others want us to. We think we're living how we want to, but really we're living how others have wanted us to. And so we've traded the fear of God for the fear of others, the fear of the culture, the fear of the crowds, the fear of the in people. And we try to live the way that they want us to rather than the way that God wants us to. And so that's at the heart of everything that we've done. And the fruit of that is that we've disobeyed God and we've broken his commandments. And we've used and abused and hurt each other, and the universe is not what it should be, and we are not what we should be, and we're separated from God. And what we see in Jesus is a God who doesn't leave us there, but a God who enters into the midst. We see a God who comes to redeem and to save and to deliver and to bring us back into relationship with himself at great cost to himself. Jesus came to show us how to live, and he came to die on the cross to shatter the barriers that keep us from him, from God. Jesus saved us from ourselves, from the debt that we owe, for the mess we've made. He came to save us from our brokenness, our guilt, and our shame. He came to mend our broken-down relationship with God, to bring us into union with God, and he has secured that union, immortalized that union. We will be with God for forever. But not only has Jesus come to do that, he's also come to change our hearts. He's come to make us new. He's come to restore us, and he now invites us to join him in restoring the whole world. For followers of Christ, life is rich with meaning. It is far from meaningless. It is rich with meaning. The teacher had the God of Israel, and he said, man, with that God, life is worth living. We have that God too, but we have even deeper and more profound revelations of that God in Jesus and in the cross and the resurrection. And we want to say life is worth it because that God is real. And we can surrender ourselves to him through Jesus and live lives rich with meaning. Ecclesiastes is a raw book about how unjust and unfair and crooked and burdensome and unpredictable life in the world can be. And the teacher says, if this life is all that there is, then there's not a lot of hope. But if it isn't, then there is hope. Maybe tonight, you're like Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., every once in a while, you think coldly about the implications of your worldview, and then you go and you distract yourself. And what I want you to do is take a couple of moments of silence and ask yourself, am I actually okay with a meaningless universe? And if not, why not? Ask yourself that and sit in that. Maybe tonight you're like Tolstoy, and you believe everything is meaningless, but you've been sitting in the implications of that for quite a while. You haven't been distracting yourself. You've been thinking coldly for a while, and you are asking yourself, why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? And if life is indeed meaningless, then I don't have an answer for you. But I don't believe that life is meaningless. Tonight I want to lift up God. I want to lift up Jesus. Jesus gave his life for yours. Jesus' life, death, and resurrection is a statement that your life matters. Your dreams matter. Your doing matters. It all matters. Maybe tonight you would consider giving yourself to Jesus, entrusting yourself to Jesus as Savior and Lord, surrendering yourself to the God revealed in Jesus. Maybe tonight you are a follower of Jesus, but every once in a while you have doubts about whether anything you say or do really matters in the end. And I want you to know that it does. You have entered into an eternal relationship with a God who is working on you, who's changing you, and who is restoring you and inviting you to help him restore all things. Everything you say and do can matter for eternity. Always think that. Always remember that. Always live in light of that. Everything you say and do in your neighborhood, in your workplace, on your campus, in your school, in your home, with your spouse, with your kids, with your roommates, everything you say and do can matter for eternity. It can outlast your death. Death cannot destroy it. Think about that. Live in light of that. Like the teacher, fear God and obey his commands, because that is what matters.